Greetings. This is Jamil Graham, sitting in for Reverend Juliet Nightingale, who will be back next week. Welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near death, out of body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after death and communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers, and you're welcome to call in to ask questions or make comments during the show. The telephone in the U.S. is 877-876-5227, or you can ring 530-876-3222. Juliet Nightingale is available for private consultations as a clairvoyant medium, as well as for spiritual and grief counseling, near-death support, and is a certified Reiki practitioner. I'd also like to encourage you to help support this program by making a donation or sponsoring a show. For more information, please visit towardthelight.org. And this week, I'm pleased to welcome back to the show PMH Atwater. Hello, PMH.
Hi, Jamil. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Well, you know, we're not really seeing each other. We're just hearing each other, but we do know each other. So in that, you know, in that greater sense, I really do see you.
I appreciate that. And thinking about these subjects, the clairvoyance, the intuition, the telepathy, and I was thinking about you before coming on to the show and just tuning in and appreciating that space that we share. And I thought, okay, this will be okay.
Yes, it will go real well.
Right there.
Well, I'm so held by the fact that we're having our show at 11 p.m. on September 11th.
Yeah, it's an interesting day.
Well, there have been ceremonies all day long, starting this morning on television, being shown, I'm sure, in various cities across our land and perhaps in other lands as well. There are ceremonies and programs and concerts and prayer and church services. So it really has become an auspicious day for a lot of people.
Yes, I was at an event earlier as well, and it was pointed out while the tragedy was something that was so traumatic, it brought so many people together, and those are all examples of how people continue to come together for whatever this day has come to represent to them and how they're processing the experience and the healing process that perhaps is connected to our whole evolution as a human species.
Well, it takes a long time to grieve. That's not something you do in a few years. I come from the Pearl Harbor generation. I was born before Pearl Harbor. So the one big event that imprinted and impacted my life was indeed Pearl Harbor. And so for me, it was a very, very big thing as an adult to finally be able to go to Hawaii, to go to the actual Arizona, the memorial of the Arizona, and to and to offer my lei, my flowers, and my prayers, and to just really be there. And for me, that was an incredible healing to be able to finally go there where it all happened, and then be walking and participating on the Arizona Memorial itself. And to I took several lays. One I dropped in the water, and one I offered to what has become an altar on the Arizona itself. So I know how much a life can be impacted by a drama like this, because it impacted my entire life. And I was very much involved in the war effort. And again, it was such a vivid thing for me. So I can appreciate and understand why it's a vivid thing for so many for so many of today's people who certainly don't remember Pearl Harbor, but they'll certainly never forget September 11th.
Hmm. When you recall how the Pearl Harbor events affected your life, do you have a specific experience that haunted you, if you will, or that kept bringing you back to the subject, and how you knew it was significant for you to allow that process to evolve inside of you? Was it in your family? Was spoken about? Did you lose particular?
Well, for me, it was walking to school. I lived then in Twin Falls, Idaho, which was a small town. But, you know, even small towns were heavily affected. And I had to walk about five blocks to school through residential areas. And I lived, I believe it was on 6th Street, and I had to walk up Shoshone to get to my school, which no longer exists. It was Washington School then. It was a great school. It is now Linwood Shopping Center. But during those days, it was a very large boulevard, and it had a lot of fine homes on it, and usually it was a pleasant walk. But after Pearl Harbor, then it was the gold stars, these large decals of a gold star. And anyone who lost a loved one in the war effort put one of these gold stars on their front room windows, so it could be seen outside on the street. So my walk to the school each morning, I passed by these gold stars in people's windows, and there were lots of gold stars. And, you know, little kids, they know what that means. And for me, just walking to school was walking a path of death, and it was every morning. And this one morning, I kid you not, this one morning I walked along the street toward my school, and there were six new gold stars in the person's window overnight. And I just stood there and sobbed. And there was not a single morning in my first grade experience that I did not have to quiet my shutters and hush my sobs in order to walk in the door to my schoolroom inside Washington School. So to say that impacted me would be an understatement.
Wow, that's a very tender age too. Okay.
So, and it took me a lifetime to make peace with gold.
Wow.
And gold stars. You know, the following years in school, and even the rest of that year, I couldn't understand why teachers would give you gold stars if you did everything right.
Hmm.
You know, if you got 100 on your test, or if you did a good drawing or so forth and so on, the teacher would put a gold star on your page.
Oh,
well,
wow.
To me, that was death. You know, and I couldn't understand why they were punishing me. And I couldn't wear gold. I couldn't even be associated with the color of gold until I was in my 50s.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I was in my 60s that I could wear gold.
For goodness sake.
Took that long.
Was there ever an opportunity to write about it or talk about it?
I finally did write a little kind of chapter about that. And some of my other experiences in one of my books called We Live Forever, The Real Truth About Death. And that incident from my childhood about the gold stars, as well as a few more incidents from my childhood about Pearl Harbor and how it affected me, are in that book. But I really want to talk about right now.
Mm-hmm.
September 11th, of course, this is the fifth anniversary, so it's an auspicious date in that it's a measurement date. You know, our fives are measurement dates, our tens are measurement dates, not the 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, but the fives, the tens, the 15s, the 20s, these are the big dates.
Uh-huh.
And so this is our first big date.
And how is it marked? Is it in like a cycle of 20, or is it in a cycle of 100, or is it in an exact?
Well, I don't know. We'll know that as time goes on, but it's certainly being marked now as the first of the measurement dates, and that's 5, the fifth year. So this is the fifth year, so that's the first of the major measurement dates that researchers use, mathematicians use. Culture uses this symbology in church, in spiritual groups. We all tend to utilize that type of measurement. Weddings, for instance, the fifth anniversary, the 10th anniversary, the 15th anniversary. You see, we go in these measurement cycles. And those are the larger anniversaries where you qualify according to tradition to get a better gift, or you know, to do bigger things.
Right, the 50th is a big deal.
Right. Yeah. So this is the fifth anniversary. So that's the first anniversary of the measurement dates.
I see.
And because it is, I know you have a story to tell about you and your mom, as connected to September 11, and I believe you were in New York City, were you?
I was.
Could you kind of share with everybody what happened to you, and then I'll kind of go into my stuff here.
Sure. I was in the city. I was at Penn Station. We were traveling out of town, and all of a sudden, all of the monitors that usually have the screen showing the schedule of trains became television showing the picture of the Twin Towers with a plane sticking out of it, and then we saw the second plane hit, and then we got on the train out to Long Island, which was the last train out to Long Island, and while we were waiting for the boat to go across to Fire Island, those monitors again were televisions, and we watched the buildings collapse.
So you were right there in New York City when it happened.
I was, and very far away.
But you didn't actually see it. You only saw it on the monitors.
Only on the monitor, correct.
Huh.
Only on the monitor, yeah.
How did you get word to your mother? Because I know she would have been frantic.
I told her telepathically all day. All the phones went down. There was no way to call. By the time we were in Fire Island, the traffic had completely stopped. There was no cars moving. There were no planes in the sky. There were only a handful of military police walking up and down the beach all day. And there was no way I could make any contact through a wire, as they were all down. So I was constantly telepathically telling her that I was all right, because she knew I was in the city. And I just kept telling her throughout the day, I'm all right. And I was, too. Auspiciously enough, I was out on the beach in a day that had no clouds in the sky, and we were sitting in the ocean with a group of people and talking and grieving and sharing, and I was all right. And I just kept sending her telepathically the energy of the seaside and that I was okay. And
did she pick it up?
She did indeed. And she did lose it a little, because by the time I got back to the city around 9 o'clock that night, I finally called, and she was so glad.
I bet. Well, now, when you finally got to Long Island and looked back, did you see the dust clouds?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was all over. From where we were seeing, you could see the smoke rising all day.
Oh, that's fascinating. You were actually there.
Yeah, coming back, I mean, the event itself was traumatic, but the events afterwards were equally paralyzing. The hostility in some of the communities and the love in the communities, the reaching out of people, and the fear simultaneous in such tremendous intensity was very humbling. It was harder for me probably the 3 months following than the day itself, just with so much energy, everybody exploding at once in some degree or the other, and all the stories of what was happening and why it was happening, and oh my goodness me, being in a spin, you know, what really happened there? And,
right, yeah. I can imagine that. The day before, in fact, several days before that, I had been in Asheville, North Carolina, giving a talk at a conference. And September 10th, that evening, I was supposed to fly home, and it was raining, started raining very, very hard, and it was grounding the planes. And we were all waiting at the airport, and I just had this very, very strong feeling that I had to get home, and I had to get home that night. I could not wait. So they offered those of us who wanted to go on another flight or take off in the morning, you know, they offered us options. And I was one of those that said, no, 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 I wanted to take my chances and go out that night.
Hmm.
So I got out on the 10th, and the rain was not bad enough to be a major deterrent. So we were able to get out, and we did a lot of bouncing in the air, but, you know, made it home safely and went to sleep that night. And in the morning, my youngest daughter called on the telephone and said, Mother, get down to the television set and turn the television set on. She did not tell me what was happening. She just said, get downstairs and turn the television set on. So I put my robe on and my glasses, and I went downstairs and turned the TV set on, and the first tower had been hit. And I then knew, of course, then you find out that all the airplanes are grounded, nothing's flying, and I understood why I had to get home the night before, because there would have been no way I could have gotten home. I didn't have the income to go another way. I would have had to have flown, because that was my ticket, that was my way home, and I could not have done so. And so I was watching all of this on the television set, and immediately I flashed back to that time when I was just a little kid in Twin Falls, Idaho, and the news came out about Pearl Harbor and what had happened. So while I was watching the television set, I was back in Twin Falls, Idaho. I was again a little kid, and the news was blaring about Pearl Harbor, and everybody up and down the streets and in and out of people's homes were screaming. They were screaming. People would run out into the streets screaming.
Wow.
And that just seared, you know, across my brain. I just never, 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 ever will forget that. Horns were honking, and people were screaming. And people were crying. So I was back there again, and it took me a little while to kind of grab myself and bring my consciousness back to this moment. And when I did, I'm a prayer chaplain. And so part of my job, as I see it, is to assist those people who are in need, who wish to have extra prayers. And especially for those who die, to whenever I can, to help escort the soul onto the other side, or to be there as a soul to help a fellow soul.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal at that moment then, when I was finally fully conscious of what was happening, was to go there and to help the souls cross over.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I left my body, and I was there in New York City. I was about a couple of blocks away. I was higher than the North Tower, but I was about a couple of blocks away, and I was hovering. And for me, this is not channeling. This is not psychic ability. This is not really even out-of-body experiences. For me, it's a witnessing, and it's a full and complete witnessing, because my sense is I'm really all there. That I'm not just a projection of myself. This is not clairvoyance. None of that.
Mm.
I was really there. I was a witness to the event. So I'm hovering about two blocks away from the North Tower, but higher than the North Tower, when I saw the second plane come in and hit it. So my sense of the event was I was physically there. To my sense, it was physical. I was physically there, fully alert and awake, all faculties functioning when this occurred and I saw the second plane hit.
Mm-hmm.
From that perch, if you will, where I was in the air. And in doing that, instantly I was inside the plane. As it hit the North Tower, I was inside the plane. And I saw three of the terrorists. I saw one in the cockpit and two in that kind of little entryway right outside the cockpit. And the one in the cockpit was very stern, sort of like a robot, a little bit older, sort of like an automaton. You know, he was just sort of numb to anything else. He was just doing what he was doing, barking orders. He was very harsh. And even though they were speaking Arabic, I understood them as English. And he was just barking out orders that they had done what they'd come there to do. Now the two in that kind of anti-way, one of them was younger, quite a bit younger than the others. And he was not told, he did not know that he was going to die. He thought that they were just going to maybe buzz the tower or something and then fly back. He did not know that he was going to be a martyr or be killed in any way. And when they hit, there was a fireball that literally consumed the plane. And I watched the fireball come closer to these two men that were standing there. And the one that was older, he knew what was happening. He knew he was going to die. He expected the fireball. He expected to go to paradise, and he was ready to go to paradise. The younger one was not, but the older one was of these two. And he welcomed the fireball, and the younger one was terrified by the fireball. And the younger one felt betrayed. He felt misinformed, he felt lied to, he felt betrayed by his fellow Muslims who were part of that scenario. And he was just utterly terrified. The one that was older, once the fireball hit and consumed them, he was screaming because he did not encounter what he thought he would. He did not face or encounter the paradise he had been promised. And he felt betrayed by his religion. And I was so caught by that, that these two men, one felt betrayed because of the people that he had trusted, and the other one felt betrayed by his religion. Because they certainly, I don't know what it was they encountered. I didn't see it, but I know it terrified both of them. It certainly was no kind of paradise. And then I was back outside the actual event, back outside in the air, and wanting very much to help the fellow souls. And there were so many bodies flailing around and bits and pieces of bodies that I couldn't be of service. I just couldn't, because there was too much, and it happened too fast, and I couldn't separate one from another, and I couldn't figure out what was happening. Again, it was just too much. So I went back to my body in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it was really kind of shook up for a little while, and spent the rest of the day in and out of prayer, joined a number of prayer groups, did everything I could in that regard. And then the next day, the next morning, I went back there. And I was expecting to help out with any souls that were still hovering who hadn't crossed yet, because not all souls cross immediately. And to help out with those that might be hanging around or feel in any way trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And And I was so shocked by what I saw that all I could do was just witness it. And what I saw was the souls involved, all of them. That means perpetrator and victim. All of them were beginning to come together and form kind of like an oscillating waveform that was in the shape of a hand, a giant hand with the fingers pointing skyward. Hmm. It was this incredible hand. And my own sense at that moment was that all the prayers from around the world, all the people that were praying for the souls and the people who were killed, that energy, that power is what enabled these souls to not only be becalmed, but also to then heal and come together in this waveform. Mm. And I was really quite surprised by that. And I was so surprised that, again, I returned to my body. And I didn't stay and then became part of prayers around the world, everybody praying. And so the third day I went back, and this is the last time I went back. The third day during that time frame. So the third morning I went back again. And then the hand was fully formed. The waveform was fully formed. Jamel, all of the souls in that waveform were fully conscious. They were fully conscious. And they all knew why they were there. They all knew what they were doing. They all knew what it was all about. There was nobody confused. There was nobody that were stragglers. They were all part of this hand. And it's like this hand or this waveform became like a protector, I guess, or it became like this huge statement, as it were. Of the souls being able then to speak to what was going on in their own way. So I lingered this time and I stayed. And the longer I stayed, I became part of the waveform. I don't know if you do use the word I was sucked in or I just somehow merged, but I became part of the waveform. And when I did, then I was able to learn what they knew. And what I was able to learn was that all of these souls, Jamel, had made a choice to be there at that city at that moment in time for this purpose before they were born. Every one of them. They had not chosen who would kill or who would be killed. That came later. They did not choose exactly how they would die or the circumstances of their death. What they chose was to be there, to lend their energy to this event, because this event was the most important event in recorded human history. The purpose of the event, I should say, in the last couple of thousand years, because the purpose of this event that they told me that I was witness to while I was inside the hand with them was that this terrorist act, and apparently we're talking destiny here, was to rent or tear that all the built-up karma in mass mind for the last 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. In other words, all the unfinished business of the last 2,000 years was able to erupt to the surface because of this event and because it happened with such force that the world would not be able to ignore it.
Mm.
So it was part of this incredible sacrifice, this incredible love, this incredible gathering of mind,
mm-hmm.
that and this is my sense here, of they knowing that we as a human family cannot go forward in our evolution into the major times ahead of us, which is the fifth world. And I wrote a book about that called Beyond the Indigo Children.
Mm-hmm.
As we move into the fifth world, that we cannot move into the fifth world as a people without finding some way of healing that what has been repressed or suppressed from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've been accumulating a great deal of karma in mass mind as a species for the last 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to be rent. It had to be lanced so that it could begin to drain and we could heal.
Mm-hmm.
And that this indeed was the purpose. And I was told while I was in there, they spoke up and said, and I quote, "Stand up, dress up, move forward, and be a part of the healing."
Hmm.
Stand up, dress up, move forward, and be a part of the healing.
Hmm.
And it was soon after that that I wrote a memorial to this event, to the whole thing.
Hmm.
And I called it The Challenge of September 11.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a free download on my website. There's a lot more to it than that.
What is your website, PMH?
My website is myname.com, so it's www.p, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, H as in Howard, at water, so that's PMHatwater.com. And, you know, it was years later, when I was in Turkey. I was in Istanbul, and I was delivering a paper on my near-death research. And there was a school teacher there who was part of the event. And she came up to me, and she said, "I have a story to tell you." She said, and most of her students in her class were Muslims. She herself was not, but most of her students were. And she said that her students, I guess about maybe 7th, 8th grade level, somewhere in there, were so upset and so ashamed and so guilt-ridden by what had happened in America at the hands of Muslim men. And they were so horrified that this had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so many innocents had been killed, and they didn't know what to do about it. It just was tearing them apart. And she had found this this piece I wrote called The Challenge of September 11. It's called, there's a little comment that says, a memorial. She had found that in her search, web search, internet search. And so she downloaded it, and she printed copies of that for every person in her class. And then they spent several days in class time reading it and talking about it. And she said, "I want you to know that because of what you wrote, my entire class was able to find healing and were able to find peace."
Very nice.
I mean, you just never know.
No.
You know?
That's the magic of expressing your voice. You never know what your song, your words, your touch, your smile, you never know how you're going to impact just one person. And to let your voice out is the gift of being alive. And to allow it to be where it needs to be. It has to come out of us. And I feel like the grieving somehow pushes us out. At the same time, it pushes us in. It pushed for me this event very strongly what it is I need to be doing. It fast-forwarded my process probably tenfold about, well, what is it that I'm supposed to be doing here besides trying to get a job and blah, 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 blah.
Like, yeah.
Where is that place, like you're describing, where my gift can come out and touch somebody and help them feel like they're a part of this, you know, and connect the dots?
Did you get the sense or the feeling that a lot of people in your own generation or maybe in years around you kind of had the same response?
No, actually, I was alone when I went through this in New Jersey. I had only one friend who was a little younger than I, and she and I had just met, and I was living in an apartment building. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have particularly kind neighbors, and I really was alone in this. I wasn't sharing with anybody what was going on inside of me. I was mostly able to listen and pray, and I can honestly say that I didn't find my generation particularly vocal or attentive to the bigger process. It seemed like my generation, I'm 43 next Saturday.
All right.
Yeah.
You're almost a birthday person. So am I, by the way.
Yay.
Right after your birthday, I turned 69.
Hey. Congratulations and happy birthday.
Yeah, congratulations to both of us.
Yay. But it seems that my generation didn't have a lot to say. It's kind of in the way of my generation. I think we're just now finding our voice. In my time, I feel like my generation is the bridge. We are watching the folks over 40 and the work that they have done to break the old traditions to make way for new consciousness to come in. That's very much a bulldozer kind of energy or shocking experience kind of energy. And our generation is the bridge, while the younger people are the ones bringing in the new energy of where we're going.
Right.
And
I've
always remembered when you want to know where we're going, you look to the children.
Right.
So,
right, and our new children are very much different. That's why I wrote the book,
yeah,
Beyond the Indigo Children.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that book and thinking about you and this and the whole idea of the consciousness evolution evolving, and I was wondering if you could connect the dots for us between the evolution of consciousness, how you see it evolving in the children, and events like September 11th, and how that we might...
Well, certainly it will impact an entire generation. I believe that the 9/11 generation began about 2002, and it's going to go on for about 20-some years, and I think that's about the... I don't have all that information up here with me, but... that particular generation, I truly feel that the millennial generation ended, and the 9/11 generation began, and all of those kids born since September 11 are going to be impacted by that one event, whether they were really part of that event or not. The energy of that event will continue to impact all of those born for the next couple of decades. I mean, it's going to impact them all.
When you are thinking about the children and particular habits or patterns in consciousness and the events of September 11th, in your experience, how it was a tearing of the, like puncturing a hole so this could all drain out, these energies of hurting, of deep tragedy. Would you say that that's part of the energy of the past 2,000 years, this some need of humanity to have this kind of violent affliction on itself. Is this part
well,
of the energy?
Well, the human family has certainly repressed a great deal and has pushed aside and ignored a great deal. There have been certain cultures and certain time frames where there has been a certain amount of healing, but we really haven't gotten down to the nitty-gritty. We really haven't. If you want to be really honest, we haven't. Abraham's sons are still fighting each other. They are. You know, you can and there's still a lot of heavy hangover from the Holocaust. But there have been many Holocausts. It wasn't just the Jewish and the Jews.
Exactly. And then the people in World War One that were decimated in the indigenous culture.
Well, Rwanda and Zaire.
Yeah, Rwanda that's decimated.
You know, I mean, America. Just an unbelievable butchery.
The violence in the streets. What is this? This phenomenon of humanity that thrives on its own blood, it seems. You know?
Yeah, so the human family has a lot to look at and a lot to consider, and this is certainly an event that is accelerating that process. Right now it doesn't look very good, but eventually I know there's already been some benefit from it, and I know there will be even more. If nothing else, it's got us all talking.
Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, it's got us all activated to one degree or another. If nothing else, we all now see that there is more going on the earth plane right now than just the usual politics, that there is really great waves of energy and great waves of what could be stirring achievement or apocalyptic tragedy or maybe even both that are now being fomented.
Mm-hmm.
So we're certainly living in different times. And September 11 was that signal. It was that one single event that says the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here we're going to have that cry. Here we're going to have that event that is so shocking, so fearful, that we can't sweep it under the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
We can't call it anything else. We're going to have to look at it. We're going to have to realize that it didn't just come from the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't just come from a crazy guy by the name of Osama bin Laden.
Right.
It came from a lot of history,
a
whole lot of history, and a whole lot of pain, and a whole lot of tears on a lot of different sides, not just one side. Did you know, Jamel, that what happened September 11 was the first real evidence in history of a global consciousness. Let me explain that. Dean Radin and his bunch, the Global Consciousness Project, had a number, I forget how many, but a number of random generators set up across the world. They were all over the world. And all of them skewed in one direction that day, and continued in that direction for an unprecedented number of hours. And this shifting of all the of all these arrows on these generators, the actual shifting toward one place on the dial, that began 3 days before the event. And the biggest shift of the actual coming together of these, I'm going to call it a dial. I don't know what its, you know, technical name is, but I'm going to call it a dial. The actual coming together of all these dials sprinkled all over the world, or, held all over the world, were 3 hours before the event.
That's
Now, if you stop for just a minute, you got to say to yourself, the world knew 3 hours before it happened that it was going to happen. It didn't know how or what, or maybe not all the details, but the world knew. The consciousness of the world knew this was going to happen. Mass mind registered this event 3 hours before it occurred. This is the first real evidence of a global consciousness. There is mass mind. There is a global mind. There is a global consciousness. This was our first proof, technical proof, that there is such a thing.
That's delicious to me. You know what that reminds me of?
It's what?
The penguins. Did you see the March of the Penguins?
Oh, yes. I loved it. I love that show.
Yeah, the beginning of the movie, all of the penguins are coming up from the ocean into this bit of ice, and they all come at the same time every year.
Yeah,
and
they just know.
Just know without a watch.
Well, we could say that's instinct, but this wasn't. And I can say, as a researcher, that I was being contacted by people 3 and 4 months before this event occurred who were being haunted in their dreams by airplanes crashing into the towers in New York City. So when we're talking not just instinct, but if we're talking mass mind reacting to an event or knowing an event or tuning into an event, then we're talking about something that is exceedingly important.
Well, would you consider possibly the collective mind, just referring to the prior part at this point, being telepathic, that there was an energy of planning, of tremendous planning that was going on in the creation of this event? And there were several people, obviously, that had to work together. There was, looking at it just strictly as an event, any event producers out there know that to produce an event of this magnitude is a huge collaboration.
I think it's more than that, Jamil, because we also had a convergence like this at Princess Diana's death and at a lot of other different major events, but nothing as big as this one. And I truly think that it wasn't just the fact that it had been planning in a number of people's minds for a long time. I think it was in the awareness of everybody's mind.
And what would the, would it be a call similar to that of service of some sort? Like, would we all be getting a message that this was coming to prepare us?
No, I don't think we knew what it was. We just knew something was, something horrific was going to occur. And all minds merged for that brief time, but all minds merged, and I think that's so important. And another thing that I think is so important, I don't know if we have time to go, to look at the numbers, the synchronicity of numbers with this event. Like the first fire station to respond was hook and ladder number 11. The date of the attack equals 11. You know, I can go on and on and on. I've got a whole half a page of these numbers that were exact. You kept getting 9-11 or 11 or 9-11, 11 over and over and over again. Didn't matter what the truck was, didn't matter what the person was, didn't matter what the incident was. It was number 11. It's like flight 11 had 92 people aboard, which equals an 11. You know, if you're doing numerology and you're adding across rather than down. Flight 77 had 65 aboard, which equals an 11. I mean, no matter where you turned, there was these incredible 11s. But if you look at the astrology of the attack, there was, and I'm not a person who works with black holes, but I know some people I really respect who do. And when you look at the astrology of the attack and compare it to our nation's chart, it connects with a black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Now, black holes open up portals to another dimension.
Oh, interesting.
And what it shows is that the battleground, it shows this so-called war on terror kind of thing. It shows this renting of mass karma. It shows this emergence of mass mind. But what it especially shows is that the battleground is consciousness. The enemy is ignorance. And the only weapons that can be used are ideologies.
Hmm. Where does the healing take place in ideologies? When you say ideologies, I think...
Well, look at the background. The battleground here is consciousness.
Right.
So it's our intent. It's our thinking. It's our mind. It's how we use our mind.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy is ignorance.
Mm-hmm. But an ideology is that...
And the weapon are ideologies. In other words, what is your thinking? What is your philosophy?
Mm-hmm.
What are your ideas?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what's going to make the difference. It's not going to be guns and mortar.
Right.
We've already seen that proof positive.
What do you think about the... I think that it requires more than head. It requires heart. And what mind are you referring to?
Well, that's part of your ideologies. That's part of your intent. That's part of your consciousness.
Okay.
You know, whenever you're talking about your heart, Jamel, you're also talking about the brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. When we are in the womb, when we are forming as little tadpoles, the same tissue that forms the brain forms the heart.
Oh, interesting.
And what we now have been able to prove and establish through science is that between 60 to 65% of the cells in the human heart are the same cells that are in our brain. And so the heart is now identified as the fifth brain structure.
Mm-hmm.
So usually when we talk about the heart, we're talking about emotions. But with this new information, I hope that invites everybody to realize that emotions have their own brain, and that emotion actually was formed first, that has the priority first, that is the first primal, not thought. Emotions come first, not thought. And we've been able to prove that.
Mm.
And, you know, that really affects mystics, that affects mysticism, that affects spirituality, because everybody says the thought is first, consciousness is first. We now know that's not true. Emotions or feeling is first. And in its own way, emotions and feelings are a brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes... your concept of all of this and how it works and its meaning and depth and all of that, and kind of twists it and turns it a little bit, and you realize, now wait a minute here, there's more involved than just sentiment. You know, usually when we speak in terms of emotions or heart, we think in terms of sentiment. There's more here, that the heart is more. Much more than what we even dreamed it was. So when we're talking about the heart and we're talking about love, we're talking about that force, that power, that organ, that vibration that really is primary, that is above and beyond all others.
Mm-hmm. Where does consciousness come from?
No one knows for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Most people feel that consciousness is a field effect,
mm-hmm.
that's the current thinking,
mm-hmm.
that it's a field effect,
mm-hmm.
that it is non-local, that it resides anywhere and everywhere, because it's a field effect. It is literally a field. And if you look at the morphogenic fields that were identified by Rupert Sheldrake in trying to understand how the mind might work, then you get even closer to the idea that maybe mind is a field effect of some kind. But then when you really get further into that, then you realize, well, it's a mighty big field effect. Because it, you know, our minds are so fantastic. They're unlimited in function, really. So if you're thinking in terms of mind and field effect, then you've got to open yourself up to, ta-da, the one mind. And the field effect of the one mind might be what we call love. And if that's true...
Is the field effect the tangible or the intangible?
It's both. You know, you usually measure most field effects with something like, well, whether it's Gauss-meter or something like that. You can't... people who are sensitive enough can see them, but people
like
who aren't don't. You know, you don't see, but you can feel them, you know, like the field effect that's around your computer. You can, if you're sensitive enough, you can feel that field effect.
Or like if you're standing next to somebody who's really angry, you
feel that. You can feel the field effect of their anger.
Somebody's really loving, you feel that
yeah, it's that vibration, that energy, that pulse, that oscillation that extends for so many inches, so many feet.
Ah, so you could spell it F-E-E-L-E-D effect.
You're getting cute.
Okay.
Yeah. So it helps us all to kind of stop. And that's a real challenge for today's people, especially today's children, to stop this idea of silence. Of thinking, of getting deep, of pulling into yourself, and all of this invites us to stop and be silent and go into that incredible fifth heart that we have, or fifth brain that we have, which is the heart, and really move into that space or field effect or whatever it is you want to call it. And get that, or at least hope, at least invite that force, that presence to envelop us.
Oh, PMH, we just got the word of that.
Yeah, we've been sort of kicked off, but that's okay. We had a good time.
Yeah, it was lovely. It was lovely and inspiring, and thank you.
Well, I invite everybody to get on my website again, pmhatwater.com.
Absolutely, and visit towardthelight.org. And
oh, that too, you bet.
Julia Nightingale will be back next week, and thanks for listening, and thank you, PMH.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.